It's my great pleasure to introduce our guest this evening, our special speaker. Inika Konin Sensei, who is a successor of Maurice Genkō Roshi. Her teacher and my teacher are both successors of Genpo Roshi. So we are, I guess that makes us cousins or something. We invited Inika tonight because she's doing really groundbreaking work that has meaning for all of us in the West as we practice, as we delve into our Zen practice in new ways, with new forms, with new light shed on different aspects of the tradition. And her focus is on women in Zen and beyond throughout the Buddhist lineage. She is also a psychologist, a teacher of mindfulness, also a mother. She has two adult sons. Before she practiced Zen, she practiced in the Shambhala transit tradition. So I'm assuming that that informs also some of her work and her practice. She says on her website that life and death has always fascinated her. So I'm not sure how that plays into this as well, but she will tell us more about it. In her work, tracing the lineage of women, she makes several points about completeness of making the lineage complete, recognizing these women, these who are valid, worthy teachers, as are the men who have been recognized. She's broadened the what it means to practice and how we practice, how women practice in a different way than men, the things that they bring to the tradition that men don't, and vice versa. Exploring different themes and situations in which that women have brought to the tradition. This has meaning for all of us, and I'm happy to see that there are virtually as many women as men here because everyone recognizes this. So I will hand it over to Inika Konin Sensei, and please welcome her and listen and share with her if there is time for questions and comments and things. Inika.
You have to unmute, Inika.
Unmute, Sensei.
Unmute.
Here I am. Can you all hear me? Okay. Well, thank you for the introduction, Russia Amy, and for the invitation, you and Joe Sensei for inviting me. I'm really honored to join you on this weekly meditation session. And I'll talk about the women ancestors. But before I go into this topic, I will share how I came to immerse myself in the study of these women. In Zen, stories are often used. Stories of practitioners from a distant past, centuries ago. And it took me some time to get used to this because these stories not only took place in a completely different era, but also in a vastly different culture. A culture that, on the one hand, deeply attracted me, but at the same time was completely different from my daily life. And from a young age, I've been fascinated by the countries from the Far East. It was kind of general fascination, without a clear image or understanding of why it intrigued me so much or what I was searching for. But when I was 21 in the 1980s, I flew to Thailand and then traveled through China and parts of Tibet for 3 months. At the time, very little was known about these countries. There was no Lonely Planet, no travel guides at all. But I was captivated by the people, the culture, and all that I saw around me. So a few years later, I returned to Asia and wandered through the Himalayas for several months. And then back in the Netherlands, I had lots of precious experiences, but what to do with it? I felt I was searching for something like essence. What's it all about? How does it all work? What's life? What's death? Can this all only be found deep down or deep up in Asia? But if it's true essence, then it had to be everywhere, also in the flatlands of my country, in my student life. Otherwise, for me, it couldn't be the essence. So no matter how much the Asian world attracted me, no matter how much I loved these Tibetan prayer flags, the monks' robes, and Chinese calligraphy, for me, it was layers covering the pure essence I was searching for. And through various detours, I eventually found my way to Zen. And now, in the end, I have a rakusu, a robe, a kesa, a teacher staff. So how strange life can be. And the only thing I know for sure is I didn't come up with this myself. Looking back, I realize it has always been about one thing. Can I let go of my ideas, expectations? Can I simply walk my path with a sense of directness, expressing my life as it is, without following a predetermined image of how it should look? So I arrived at Zen, in the Sangha of Zen in daily life, the Sangha of my teacher Maurice Roshi. And at that time, there were hardly any external elements, no robes, no formal services, no reciting of the four vows. There wasn't even a Buddha statue inside. But somehow I felt that it was about the essence, whatever that meant. And Maurice often spoke from ordinary situations, relationships, work, raising children. But the old Zen stories were also discussed. Strange stories, incomprehensible koans. So what on earth did that have to do with my daily life? And over time, I began to recognize that it didn't matter that it was about a different era, centuries ago, and about a vastly different culture. The questions, the longing, they are the same, and the essence is the same. And that was an incredible, remarkable recognition for me. And how valuable, because recognizing that so many people before me have undertaken this quest, day after day, they allow this indescribable longing to pass through them, even if they didn't understand it, just as I still don't understand it. Our Buddhist ancestors are of great importance. They are a source of support on the sometimes lonely journey, I think. The journey to the essence, or as you say in Zen, our Buddha nature, our true face before our parents were born. And the story of every person who has practiced before us offers another perspective on the elusive, the boundlessness. And what a gift to have all these stories, to hear these ancestors, to taste them, to be them. What a gift that each of them lived it and passed on the Dharma till our time. And as Zen stories seeped into my bones, something started gnawing at me. At first in the background, but gradually I became aware of it. The women. Where were the women ancestors? Because nowadays there are many female teachers, though only in the West. Just look at your own Sangha with your teacher Amy Roshi and her teacher Gena Roshi, your Dharma grandmother. But before Gena Roshi, according to the lineage, she's the 82nd generation from the Buddha, I think. All 81 teachers before her, before Gena Roshi, were men. Although some scholars speculate that Prajnatara, the teacher of Bodhidharma, may have been a woman. But anyway, many male teachers and patriarchs. The question about women practitioners and women Zen masters started to occupy my mind more and more. Had they never existed? Why not? Had there been only male teachers in India, China, Japan? And I discovered that there had been female Zen masters, and I experienced that these histories, what we know about these women, as well as the gaps and the missing pieces, are very important because they are part of our existence. Joan Sutherland Roshi, an American Zen master, puts it this way. The spring from which the Dharma flows is a direct experience of the nature of reality. That's ungendered. It doesn't have anything to do with those kinds of dualities at all. And at the same time, we can only have direct experience through this phenomenal world. And the phenomenal world is, amongst other things, gendered. So, if we leave out a whole body of ways that the direct experience of the nature of things can be expressed, or the ways we can practice towards seeing that, we are dealing with something partial and therefore unnecessarily limited. We are dealing with something that is not as whole as it could be. That seems to me to be the fundamental issue. End of the quote. You could say it's about completing the family tree. Imagine having a family tree that includes only your daughters and sisters, if you have them, your mother, your aunts, your grandmothers, the mother of your grandmothers. You hear stories about them, how they lived, what they did, and so on. But the men in your family are rarely spoken of, and you know nothing about them. That wouldn't just be strange. It would be a great loss, a loss of your history, and thus a loss of a part of yourself. By studying all our ancestors, both male and female, we complete ourselves. When we look at female practitioners and Zen masters throughout the centuries, it becomes clear that much less is known and written about them. There are many reasons for this, and these reasons are quite fascinating for us as Western practitioners in our daily lives. One reason why there is less known about women in Zen is the three obediences that women in China and Japan had to adhere to. As girls, they had to obey their fathers. As wives, they had to obey their husbands, since, of course, they married. And if their husbands passed away, they had to obey their sons. So a woman was therefore under the authority of a man for nearly her entire life and could not simply be ordained. And additionally, there were fewer monasteries for women compared to those for men. These nunneries received only a fraction of the financial support that monasteries did. And furthermore, as in many parts of the world, women received much less education, meaning they could not easily study Buddhist texts. This resulted in nuns having a different kind of practice compared to monks. Alongside meditation, recitation, and a bit study, practice by nuns also largely consisted of social activities such as nursing the sick, providing basic education, and even sewing and knitting clothes for monks to help them endure the cold seasons. So nuns developed various activities to sustain themselves, with formal practice being just one part of their lives. And lay women who practiced Buddhism, since they could not enter a convent, did so alongside their duties within their families and households, working, providing care, raising children, while integrating their Buddhist practice into their daily lives. They sometimes had a koan given to them by a Zen master and let that resonate throughout the day. That was their practice. All in all, the practice of women shares many similarities with the modern day Zen practitioners, doesn't it? And a non-monastic practice, a practice within family life, is nothing new. We can look to our Dharma grandmothers for guidance. The number of female Zen masters mentioned in historical records is very small. And I thought, were there really so few female Zen masters? Were there truly so few women who recognized their true nature? It's also possible that their awakening was simply not seen by male Zen masters. Women were often seen as spiritual less capable. A Zen master was expected to have a certain appearance, a certain character, and a certain way of behaving. To attain awakening, one had to be Da Zhang Fu, a Chinese term often encountered, meaning a determined fellow with great willpower. So less was written about women, and far less was written by women. Perhaps documentation itself is a medium that has historically been more suited to men. This still seems to be the case today. For instance, it's estimated that about 85 to 90% of Wikipedia editors are men, while only 10 to 15% are women. And this has consequences for the content on Wikipedia, as topics traditionally seen as male are overrepresented, known as Wikipedia's gender gap. Something same might have happened in the historical records of Zen. So because documentation in Zen was primarily done by men, we must keep in mind that what was written down reflects a male perspective, how men saw women's practice. Fortunately, some stories about women ancestors have been preserved. Not only does their context often surprisingly align with our present-day context, but they also enrich the themes, metaphors, and situation in Zen practice. For instance, the theme of sexuality frequently appears in the stories of female ancestors. In stories about monks, sexual feelings are often externalized. The woman is seen as the temptress and must therefore be excluded. However, in a few stories about nuns who are confronted with this view, this labeling often takes a humorous turn, with the nun delivering a very direct and delicate Dharma teaching to the monk in question. All situations are workable. Nothing is excluded. Sexual feelings are part of practice too. Even in a monastic setting, as these feelings are purely human, neither good nor bad, and cannot simply be eradicated by celibate vows. In the late 1990s, the search for women ancestors led to various American sanghas compiling lists of female predecessors. This was based on the emerging research into female practitioners throughout history, and this list eventually culminated in a Zen women ancestors document. It's also on my website, womeninzen.org. This document takes the form of a circle containing dozens of names of mythical ancestors. Mythical women such as Prajnatara, Kanzeon, followed by the names of enlightened women from India. It starts at about 6 o'clock. If you see it clockwise, 6 o'clock, then the Indian ancestors, most of whom lived during the Buddhist time. Then come the names of the Chinese female ancestors, followed by the Japanese female ancestors, and the circle is completed with a small section for Western female ancestors, where the current Zen teacher adds his or her name upon transmission, in the same way as is done in the lineage of male ancestors. The transmission line has unfolded differently for women than it has for men. It's not a lineage in the literal sense, apart from the fact that the male lineage is also not historically accurate in personal transmission from teacher to student to student. Transmission among women has generally taken a different course. And this is because there were so much less women Zen teachers. In some cases, transmission went directly from female Zen master to student, but more often it was like an invisible, seeping throughout space and time. A comparison might clarify the difference between this male and female transmission. In London, the Thames flows, a clear river with a starting point and a place where it empties into the sea. However, London also has many underground rivers, such as the Fleet, the Brent, the Rum, and many others. And here, the water flows underground for miles before resurfacing further on. And although not directly visible as a river or a creek, these underground streams leave their traces above the ground in the landscape through vegetation and thus have their influence. And in the same way, the influence of many female masters from the past can be seen, not in the form of a concrete line, but still impacting subsequent generations. So till now, the information about Zen women often remains sparse. Parts have been lost, documents have disappeared, many gaps remain. But at the same time, doesn't that fit perfectly with Zen? Reading between the lines, groping our way in the dark, and listening with our eyes. Isn't that exactly what Zen is about? Going beyond words, letting go of concepts, judgments, opinions, and stepping into the dark. I think this attitude can help us allow our female ancestors to speak to us and let the Dharma they passed down seep through into our current practice. Vanya, I would like to share something about a woman Zen master who lived around the year 1100 in China. At birth, she was given the name Zidong. She grew up in a wealthy family with access to books. She was able to study well and in some ways was even more educated than her brother, for example, in algebra. Although she didn't want to marry, her father arranged a suitable match, the grandson of the prime minister. Zidong could not endure the glittering life of luxury and all its obligations. It was everything she so did not want. So she asked her husband for a divorce. He let her go, after which Zidong asked her father for permission to be ordained. However, her father refused, insisting that she care for him and her mother, as conventions dictated, and the three obediences. So Zidong decided to practice within her daily life. She adopted a simple lifestyle, meditated and contemplated. And between her household duties, she occasionally visited Zen masters and was given the name Kongxi Daren. Kongxi was unable to follow her deep longing to fully devote herself to Buddhist practice. And I wonder, how did she deal with the emotions that arose from this limitation? I imagine that she was frustrated, maybe disappointed, sad, sometimes lonely. Whatever the case, she had to absorb these feelings But she did not let them dictate her. She did not become apathetic. She carried on and sought the practice that was possible within her situation. And how do we do that? How do we deal with something we don't want? How do we handle the emotions that arise from situations we don't want? Can we make space for resistance? Can we sit with frustration in our body? Can we allow and feel powerlessness? Every one of us faces these kinds of emotions, whether from our personal circumstances, the political situation, the war in Ukraine, Gaza, or elsewhere, or the climate crisis. We all are known with these kind of feelings. And can we acknowledge what these feelings stir up without pushing them away or following our impulse to fix the situation, to solve what cannot be solved? Can we breathe it, the situation? Can we breathe it rather than place it outside ourselves as something that doesn't conform to our expectations? Can we sit with it without turning away because we don't want to feel powerlessness and frustration? A text Kangxi used for her practice says, "The One contains and permeates all. All contains the One and permeates the One. The One contains the One and permeates the One. All contains all and permeates all. They penetrate without obstruction." Okay, not an easy text. A text that confounds the thinking mind and invites looking beyond. Eventually, Kangxi reached deep inside. She realized nothing stands alone. There is nothing outside of me. Every part contains all the others, and also everything contains the One, the groundless. Everything is part of the whole. And nothing, absolutely nothing, is excluded. Mind blowing, mind blowing. Everything is interconnected and influences everything else. And so it was in Kangxi's life. Nothing stood apart. Everything mattered and was part of the whole, regardless of whether she wanted it or approved it. Even the fact that she could not be ordained, and everything that is evoked within her, was part of the whole. Then her parents passed away, and she asked her brother if she could now enter the monastery. He refused. Again, the three obediences. He insisted that she care for him. At the end, when Kangxi was 61, her brother died. He left her financially secure And Kongxi was finally free, free to become a nun. But through her years of practice, she had realized that practice is not about separating oneself from the world. You cannot separate yourself from the whole. You are the whole. A monastery, a robe, that's not what it's about. Practice is about clarifying your mind, being awake, and expressing that in daily life. She continued to visit a Zen teacher regularly, and after a short time, she received transmission. But Kongxi did not establish herself as a Zen master. She did not become an abbess. She did not take on students. Instead, she opened a bathhouse. She became self-employed, a micro-entrepreneur. And on the door, she hung a poem that said, among other things, nothing truly exists, so why would you take a bath? Where could even the slightest speck of dust accumulate? And further on in the poem, hanging on the door of her bathhouse, if you wish to go beyond impurity, you will have to sweat through every pore. People say that water can wash away impurity, but can you see that the water itself is also dirty? Even if you no longer distinguish between water and dirt, you must still wash everything away before entering here. A remarkable text for a bathhouse, I think. It says there's absolutely nothing to do. Where could even the smallest speck of dust settle? And yet, you must practice to see your true nature. But even then, even that insight, that experience, you must let go also. Have you eaten? Wash your bowl. At the end of her life, at age 74, she closed the bathhouse, moved into a convent, and formally took ordination in the end. And there, she became deeply significant to lay practitioners, monks, and nuns. And it said that many awakened under her guidance. But for Kongxi, it was clear. Washing a robe or a bath towel, what's the difference? It's not about rakusas, robes, or ordinations. That's not the essence. Just look, really look, and exclude nothing. And simply do what needs to be done. Thank you for listening. So this was my talk about our Zen women ancestors. And I hope, yes, I think we have some time for questions, remarks. So we can open up, I think.
Yeah, thank you, Ineke. Thank you so much for your talk. So many questions pops up, but one is I'd like to ask you if in the writings that you encountered, have you noticed a sense of the stories are more, I don't know, this is my guess, but more gentle than what we usually find in, in the interactions between men. It's like sometimes we are a little bit taken apart by, the violence that takes place in the stories. I'm wondering if in when it's about women, if it has a different flavor.
Well, I think it's less about the blows and beating up sometimes, but much less. And there are also poems by women who tell about the love and the support between the women and the practitioners. And I think these themes are more in the poems and the texts written by women than men. But what I also said that in my talk that lots of what we know and what we read about these women is written down by men and seen through the eyes of men and what they saw as a Zen master. So I think it's a bit colored, but there is difference, yes. Are there any other questions, remarks? I'm happy to hear from you.
Don't be shy. Don't be shy, wildflowers.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think it's fascinating to hear so candidly about a certain discrimination that existed even in Zen. Actually, I already knew about the three obediences that Chinese women had, their father, their husband, their child. And yes, it strikes me that there's a great big of great difference between the liberties that were afforded to men and to women. So thank you so much for your investigation about this.
I'm happy to hear that it's that it brought you something, and yeah, I think I just have some practical thing. My battery doesn't charge at the moment. I just have a look, otherwise I will go black within a few minutes. Excuse me.
João, just while Ineke is doing this, I was wondering if we could somehow share the screen with the lineage that she mentioned. I think it's on her website, if somebody wanted to look it up and share it.
Okay, I can look it up. Yeah.
May I talk?
Yes, go ahead, Krisha. Yeah.
Good evening, all. Thank you very much, Inika, for or Sensei, for your beautiful talk. And it was really beautiful. Well, it's a really complex theme, so I don't want to just to talk and talk and talk. But I don't know your work. I know I want to know it. But thank you very much for helping us rehaving our wholeness, as you said, in phenomenal world we are women and men, and it's a bit strange, of course. I think it's very beautiful for you to recollect those episodes in our ancestors for us to regain that wholeness and that touch of wholeness again. And it made me very happy. And the story you told us, which also touches a bit of taking care of what reality is asking right now, and somehow recognizing that as Zen. Also, it's something our Roshi Aimi always teaches, is to bring Zen to our daily life. And sometimes it's quite difficult to understand it and to see how to go beyond retreats, sessions, and the whole Zen ritual practicing, and to bring it to our daily life. And I found out your talk really. My English is not perfect. Insightful, the story you told and bring us, and thank you very much.
Thank you for your reaction, Krisha. Yes, I was told that when I started with Zen, that it was new to have practice in daily life, that it was always been monastic, and that we had to find out how to do it. And after years, I saw that's not true. We have so many examples. We have so many grandmothers, and sure, there are also grandfathers who just practiced in daily life. And for me, that gave so much strength to know that I'm not the first one, that we are not the first generation to here in the West to find out how to do that work and practice Buddhist practice together. Actually, it's done from the beginning, I think. Even at the Buddhist time, he had his community consisted of four elements: the monastics, the men, the monks, but also the nuns, and also the lay men, and also the lay women. And it's said that all those four sections were even important to him. And we still have the names of people of all those four sections, although mostly we are told about just one section, the monks during the time of the Buddha. But I think it broadens our mind, and it broadens the perspective and the stories and the possibilities when we hear also these stories about the other sections and about practicing in daily life. And for me, it's also the example I gave about a family tree. It would be strange to have just half a family tree. we feel complete, I think, with a whole family tree. And I think it's for men as well as women important to know all our ancestors. That it can deepen our practice. Yes. Is there anybody else who want to
I would like
share something?
To make right. So throughout your research, I guess that you found out that by now most of the teachers, senseis, roshis, they are Western people. Or do you see that also in the Eastern countries, Japan and China, where Zen is still alive, or particularly in Japan, if there is this drive for women also to get to become knowledge as spiritual guides and leaders? I mean, did you, in your research, did you find out that most of, by now, not in the past, but in our contemporary times, do you find out that there is a tendency to acknowledge women, spiritual leaders in the West over the acknowledgement in Japan or in China?
Is your question that if the women teachers in the West have the same knowledge?
Yeah, my question is to know, is to find out if throughout your research nowadays, if you found out that you have more spiritual teachers, women spiritual teachers in West than in the East. I mean, if this still, I guess, Japanese traditional culture prevents women to be acknowledged as teachers, whereas in the West, like in your case or Amy's, we have by now many women teachers. Because of course that relates with the transformations that happen, especially in liberal countries where women have more rights and all that.
I haven't done much research at the present time, but I know that in Japan there are still not many women teachers, and also the women teachers from the West are often seen as not at the same level as the male teachers in Japan. For example, Roshi Joan Halifax was in Japan, I think, about half a year or a year ago, and she was there at Engakuye, the temple of Dogen Zenji, and I think it was for the first time that, and she was the first women Roshi from the West who entered the monastery and had a privilege to be there. So then we talk about 2024. Yeah. So there's still a difference between the East and the West in treating the male teachers and the female teachers.
So you would say there are not many chances in these Eastern countries or in Japan, at least.
Well, it's growing. It's becoming better and better, but it's still taking time. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And that, of course, has to do with the predominance of this patriarchal society in the East. In the East, yeah, you still have this very strong trend of the patriarchal tradition, I guess, over there.
They have that more than we here in the West. That's true. Yeah, yeah. But also here, we have quite subtle patriarchal opinions, and also here it's there's that there's a difference, and that patriarchal vision is not only in men, eh? It's in women and men. It's in our whole society, and therefore I think it's important for both men and women to know more about our female ancestors, because it influences us. It's not about it's about the not only the persons and the genders, but also about energy, the male and female energy. And each person, no matter what gender you're aligned to, each person has male and female energy, and it's about balancing this energy for yourself, because that gives freedom to react in a situation, to give a response which suited for the situation and not fixed by the structure of the society. It's not fixed and petrified by our visions in this culture. So it's important to becoming more free, to know more of all this kind of people and all these kind of energies.
Yeah. I wonder if this female energy, as you said, would have taken over. I would be if in the past this female energy would be more balanced with the male energy within the practice of Zen. I wonder how it. Well, you gave some examples, of course, of women that were practicing, but in a very hidden way. I mean, the image you gave of the river was very beautiful. But anyway, it was as it was clandestine. It was as if it was out of the record. So it would be interesting to know if this female energy was not also repressed within this patriarchal context of male Zen practice. I wonder.
We'll never know. There's a lot of speculation, but we have to do it with what's right here and right now. But I think it's interesting, and that therefore I made this website and studied all those women in the circle to look for their stories and to look in which context they lived and how their lives were, because then we get more to know about them. Yeah. So there are about there are more there are about 80, more than 80 women, I think. And well, you can read all those stories on the website. Yeah. Some are a bit short, and I've also very extensive stories on it, because then you can more dive into their lives. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I think we are out of time, unfortunately.
It is, yeah.
Ineke mentioned her website. I think it's womeninzen.org,
Org.
right? Very rich, lots of material there. Someone had asked me if it's possible to download that chart, and is it a quality image that we could print or something? Or do you know?
Yes, there's a download button for the circle. Yeah.
Okay.
And there's also my mail address. So If anybody has any question, you're always welcome to mail me. I'm happy to answer your mail and have conversations about it.
Thank you very much, Ineke.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ineke, for embodying.
Yeah.
For embodying the subject. I'm very happy to meet you this way. And thank you, Emmy Roshi, for inviting me.
Thank you for coming, my sensei friend and sister. So we will end with the four vows. Everyone mutes and then we chant. So the Eno will chant.